Okay, this works. So my job is to talk about the weird neutrino things that you can try to do. So the idea is to talk about, other neutrino properties and tests of asymmetries that you can do with neutrino physics. So this is my goal. Let me start off by saying why everybody's really excited about neutrinos. And since we're forced to be inside an auditorium in Paris in June when the sun is out, I will entertain you with a little bit of pictures. And we're very excited about neutrino physics because we think that our picture of the standard model has changed. It hasn't changed very much, and in some way, maybe it got brighter. But the idea is that before, we had massless neutrinos. So we had a model which has a gauge symmetry, SU3 cross SU2 cross U1. It had a bunch of global symmetries at the Lagrangian level. So it had a baryon number symmetry, and it had three individual lepton number symmetries. And of course, there's no such thing as a leptonic CP violation effect that you could have come up with because the neutrinos had no mass. Now, the picture has changed a lot, but at least this part of the picture didn't change. Our formalism also didn't change, so we still use, say, quantum field theories. That's nice. On the other hand, the neutrino mass has completely killed at least two of these three symmetries. So in principle, the baryon number still is conserved, we think. And the question is whether an overall lepton number is still conserved. And of course, this is an experimental question. And of course, now that the neutrinos have mass, there's no reason why leptonic CP invariants should be conserved. But again, this is another experimental question. Since nobody has talked about this yet, I thought I should do it. Actually, we have no idea how neutrinos get a mass, but we certainly know how to parameterize it. We have genetically two ideas. One idea is to say that the neutrino mass is coming out of some higher dimensional operator that you can write down in the standard model. What does that mean? It means that you write down the old standard model Lagrangian and you add this operator. It's not a renormalizable operator, which tells you that this theory is a good theory only up to some scale m. This is a very nice model because in this model, you understand why the neutrinos have such a tiny mass. And the reason is that somehow the scale m is much, much bigger than the electroweak scale. What's really exciting about this model, of course, is that the neutrinos turn out to be Majorana fermions, so lepton number can't be defined. Lepton number is violated. Of course, there's the other logical possibility that nobody likes to talk about very much, is that maybe the neutrinos are Dirac fermions. So what you do is you introduce a Yukawa coupling to the neutrino, and the idea is that the neutrino gets a mass just like everybody else. Now, the challenge here is to explain, or to at least swallow the fact that you need a Yukawa coupling which is less than about 10 to the minus 11. Well, that sounds really bad. The electron Yukawa coupling is like 10 to the minus 6, so we have absolutely no idea why that's the case. But somehow people don't like 10 to the minus 11. That's too small. 10 to the minus 6 is fine. Of course, this is a renormalizable Lagrangian, so it's very similar in spirit to the old standard model. It has a new degree of freedom, this usually called right-handed neutrino field. It's just a singlet fermion that you have to add to your Lagrangian. Now, of course, in this case, the neutrinos are Dirac fermions and lepton number is conserved. There's an interesting fact, which is that you actually have to explain that. If lepton number is conserved, we have to understand why it can't be violated. Somehow, lepton number becomes a very important symmetry. And we'd have to understand at a very fundamental level why that happens to be the case. And I'm not going to talk about this. Either way, all that I want to say about this is that we have this a minimal understanding of how to put in neutrino masses in our model without really understanding why they're there, but we can at least parameterize them. And the really important thing, of course, is that there are no other observables except for neutrino masses that you can come up with. There's no other observable effect of these models here that you can go in a laboratory and look for. Except, of course, for what happens with lepton number, whether it's conserved or not. And of course, this is a question for neutrino-less double beta decay, which is important enough that we actually have three or four talks on this. So I'm not going to talk about this very much. But clearly, this is the only, thing that will tell you whether you're living with a Lagrangian that looks like that or a Lagrangian that looks like that. And of course, maybe there's a C here, which we don't know what it looks like. Now, what I'm going to talk about, of course, is now we have we can try to look for more exotic stuff. So we have an opportunity because now neutrinos have mass. So once neutrinos have mass, they can do other things as well. They don't have to, but they might. So the goal is we have to try to look for these more exotic properties of neutrinos. And of course, the other important thing is that we have a lot of data, or we're going to have a lot of data. And what I'll talk about a little bit is the fact that because neutrinos have mass, they can have a magnetic moment. And because neutrinos have mass, they actually have to decay. At least the heavy ones have to decay. There's nothing that forbids them from decaying, so they do decay. Of course, the question is, how long does that take? So I'm going to talk about this a little bit. We're going to have a talk on magnetic moments later on, so I'm not going to talk about this very much. Now, of course, the other thing you can do with neutrinos is you can test fundamental symmetries. And in particular, you can test fundamental space-time symmetries. So you can test for, say, whether CP and T invariants are conserved in the leptonic sector. You can look for whether Lorentz invariance is conserved. And of course, you can ask whether CPT invariance is conserved. So I'm going to spend most of my time talking about that, given that I have time at the end. So the neutrino magnetic moment. Now, the fact that neutrinos have mass means that they can have a magnetic moment. Actually, it's more than that. If the neutrinos have mass, they must have a magnetic moment. And of course, the nature of the magnetic moment will depend on what the nature of the neutrino is. Because if the neutrino is a Majorana field, there are certain properties that it has, which, for example, the neutrino magnetic moment is written in this way, where these nus are supposed to be vial spinners, if you know what that means. And there's an interesting property here is that this magnetic moment matrix has to be anti-symmetric. So there are no diagonal magnetic moments if they're Majorana fields. If they're Dirac fields, now I wrote these as Dirac fermions. And now you just have a generic 3x3 magnetic moment matrix. So you can try to go out and look for these. I've also mentioned that now that the neutrino has mass, it must have a magnetic moment because it gets one at the loop level. And you can go out and you can calculate it. So in this new standard model where the neutrinos have mass, this thing is incredibly small. Okay, how small is it? You can calculate it. The diagonal magnetic moments that you can try to calculate if the neutrino are Dirac fermions are easy to calculate. They come in at one loop electroweak level. And people have a tendency of writing them in terms of Bohr magnetons. So the neutrino magnetic moment is about 10 to the minus 20 Bohr magnetons. Okay, what does that mean? Okay, how do we look for that? We can look for that in a variety of ways. You can look for that by doing neutrino electron scattering. So if you do neutrino electron scattering, the magnetic moment gives you an extra contribution to neutrino electron scattering. And in particular, it doesn't even have to be electron neutrino electron goes to electron neutrino electron. It can be electron neutrino electron goes to any other neutrino electron, and you can even violate lepton number. Of course, we have no way of detecting this neutrino. We only get information on the electron. But of course, this here will give you a limit on linear combinations of these coefficients of the magnetic moment matrix. Another way of looking for that is to take advantage of magnetic fields in the sun and the fact that the neutrinos oscillate. So what a magnetic moment can do for you is to turn an electron neutrino into some other flavor of antineutrino, for example. And then neutrino oscillations will make that into an electron antineutrino. And you can look for a flux of electron antineutrinos coming from the sun. And this, of course, is something that Camlin can do very well. It's something that Super K also has bounds on. So there are lots of bounds on that. And there's also a couple of posters on this. So I invite you to go and look at it. Of course, in order to get maximum information about this, you really would like to know the oscillation parameters very well, because oscillation effects and magnetic moment effects tend to mix with each other, and then you get confused. Of course, Camlin helps a lot because it tells us what the oscillation parameters are. So that's the thing that will allow you to bind magnetic moments from the sun. Now, there are lots of bounds from astrophysics as well. I'm not going to talk about this very much. If you open the PDG into the electron neutrino section, there is a PDG accepted bound that the neutrino magnetic moment is less than about 1.5 times 10 to the minus 10 Bohr magnetons. Then you look at the standard model prediction, and you see that we have a ways to go. And of course, there are more stringent bounds from solar neutrinos and astrophysics that are not universally accepted because they have some model dependency on them. Now, of course, there's no way that we can test the standard model prediction for the magnetic moment of the neutrino because we don't know how to improve things by 10 orders of magnitude in less than 50 years or so, and I'm being sort of generous, I think. Of course, what happens is when you look for a magnetic moment, what you're actually doing is you're looking for bread and butter new physics at the electroweak scale. We know that, generic new physics at the electroweak scale will give you effects in these precision measurements. And for example, you can imagine that if you have a new physics scale, M nu, that will generate a magnetic moment for the neutrino that could be much bigger. And one reason for that is that you actually can not, you can avoid paying the price of a neutrino mass and you replace it by some other mass, like maybe a fermion mass. And if you get lucky, this could be, say, the top mass, which would be nice. So basically, searches for neutrino magnetic moments are actually searches for new physics, just like things like looking for mu to E gamma, looking for the anomalous G minus 2 of the muon, looking for electric dipole moments, and so on and so forth. Of course, this is easy to understand, because if you look at it, this kind of an operator here, if instead of neutrinos you write lepton doublets, is exactly what gives you the anomalous G minus 2. It also gives you mu to E gamma. And if it has complex phases, it also gives you EDMs. So it's not a surprise. And of course, every time you can relate neutrino physics to a charged lepton physics, the neutrinos lose because charged lepton bounds are very stringent. But there's always a logical possibility that there's some funny effects which are hidden and just in the neutrino sector. So let me just mention a few words. So by looking for neutrino magnetic moments, you can place bound on things like supersymmetry. Large extra dimensions are kind of fun, because if you have a neutrino in extra dimensions, when you do this experiment here, when you do neutrino electron scattering, you actually produce a whole tower of Kaluza-Klein neutrinos, and you can place bounds on that. And you can actually get some information of whether that's going on or not because of the different kinematics of each individual state. And of course, there are all the other usual suspects that I'm not going to list over here. Okay, another thing is that if the neutrino has mass, I think I wrote that down, the heavier neutrino mass eigenstates are unstable. They're not protected by any symmetry, so they will decay. So they will eventually decay into the lighter guys and some other stuff. Now, we don't know what this other stuff is, but we do know what this other stuff is if the new standard model is correct. This other stuff has to be photons and the other light neutrinos and antineutrinos. There's no other choice. Of course, this is one decay you can look for. A certain neutrino goes into another neutrino and a photon. This is governed by the same kinds of operators that give you magnetic moments. And you can calculate what the neutrino lifetime is for this particular decay in the new standard model. And of course, it's absurdly long. So the neutrino lifetime is bigger than 10 to the 38 years. So I think if you look at all of the neutrinos in the universe, I think a few of them might have decayed by now, but not many. And this is for a neutrino mass of about 1 eV. The reason this is really big is because this process is Gym suppressed. This here, if you've never thought about this is a flavor-changing neutral current process. And these are Gym suppressed. And the Gym suppression here is proportional to the charged lepton masses divided by, say, the W mass. So it's a pretty big suppression on top of the fact that the neutrinos have a really tiny mass. So of course, there are the other decays, like the neutrino into three neutrinos. It has a lifetime of about 10 to the 39 years. And because we have some constraints on the magnetic moments already, the constraints on the lifetime of the neutrino are pretty big. They're about 10 to the 11 years. Of course, you can get around this by imposing that other stuff is going on in the standard model. And there are all sorts of things you can think about. There's the ordinary bread and butter 1 over m nu physics scale type of events that can enhance the lifetime of the neutrino into decaying into, say, photons or other neutrinos. Here, things get a little bit more exciting, because you can also assume that the neutrino can decay into, say, another neutrino and some other stuff that we've never seen before, which is very light. So for example, some massless scalar or pseudoscalar. And people talk about, say, Majorana models, where the neutrino mass is, where lepton number gets spontaneously broken. Of course, the experimental bounds on the neutrino lifetime are kind of annoying, because they vary from the billions of years scale to the hundreds of microseconds scale, because that will depend a lot on what the decay mode is. So when you think about neutrino bounds, the best model-independent bounds come from solar neutrinos. And it's easy to guess what that kind of bound will be. The sun is very far away, so that gives you a pretty good time that it takes for the neutrino to get here. And we know that they're not decaying very much. But the problem with neutrinos is that they're really boosted. So that's why you don't, that's why you can't really get a very good bound from that. So the kind of bound you get is about 10 to the minus 4 seconds. Again, there are posters discussing other types of bounds that you can get on neutrino lifetimes if we ever get lucky and if we have a detector that can study, say, relic supernova neutrinos. And people have talked about bounds on high-energy cosmic rays by measuring this 1-to-1-to-1 prediction for the flavor ratios from neutrinos produced very far away. So this is the thing that I will not talk about because Sergey did talk about this. In the neutrino sector, we believe that CP invariance has to be violated, and there are lots of ways of doing that. And in particular, these first two ways are the ones that we've been spending a lot of time talking about for next generation neutrino experiments. We have some hope of doing things with neutrino less double beta decay to see the Majorana CP violation, whatever that means. And of course, there's some more speculative things that people have talked about. Now, let's go to something completely different. So, what I want to talk about last is, we want to test things which are really weird. So somehow, if we can actually verify that any of these two things happen to be violated, then we're in trouble and we're actually entering a completely new territory. By the way, this thing is in Paris, so you can go out and see it if you want. So tests of Lorentz invariance violation, and I'll talk about this very quickly. So what happens is if Lorentz invariance gets violated, the important thing is that the neutrino dispersion relation gets modified. So for neutrino, e squared minus p squared isn't m squared anymore. If that happens to be the case, then what's important for us here is that the L over E oscillatory behavior of the neutrino gets modified as well, and we can try to probe that. We can put bounds in such effects. I was going to discuss one example. I'm not going to talk about this very much. There are lots of people that have talked about how to do a spontaneous breaking of Lorentz invariance. One very easy way is to couple the neutrino to some vector field. And now you take this vector field and you make it have a VEV. You just impose that. So Lorentz invariance gets spontaneously broken because there's some preferred direction in space-time. You want to be careful and make sure that, you know, that'll be in the time direction in the frame where we do experiments, because otherwise, you know, neutrinos coming from over there will behave differently from neutrinos coming from over there. And we're bound to know about this sometime or another. And we don't even know what over there means anyway. So, you know, this is one idea. And what happens in this case, for example, is that the neutrino dispersion relation gets modified in this way. Actually, this model here, if this guy gets a VEV, also violates CPT, because a neutrino and antineutrino get a different dispersion relation. And the reason this is really nice is because this looks exactly like what we know about matter effects. So matter effects look exactly like this. This is how matter effects come about when the neutrinos are propagating in matter. So we can use our intuition to find bounds on things. You can calculate what the survival probability of the neutrinos are. And the bottom line is, of course, that the neutrinos will have a different effective mixing angle. And the important thing is that this mixing angle will depend on the energy. So that's a little weird. And the other thing is that the L over E behavior gets violated. So you can place bounds on that. I'm not going to do any detailed analysis, but we know how to place bounds on this. Basically, because we haven't seen any of these weird effects, we know that these matter potentials, and they're not really matter potentials because this is a property of vacuum now. So it looks like an ether in some sense. So it's an ether potential, if you want to think about it that way. That better be small than the delta m squared over 2e, so that these are sub-leading effects that we haven't had access to. And the kinds of bounds that you can put on these numbers are at the order of, say, 10 to the minus 21 GeV. And we write this down in GeV because it looks more impressive. If you write it down in electron volt, it doesn't look very exciting. But anyway, this is the kind of thing. And there's a poster that actually talks about this. These bounds can be much more stringent than this, of course, because this is just a really conservative bound. And maybe this thing is, say, 0.1, or maybe it's at the percent level. Of course, Lorentz invariance violation is incredibly rich, because you can think about, you know, hundreds of parameters that you can come up with. And people have even studied in this paper here, for example, whether you can use only Lorentz invariance violation to explain all of the neutrino oscillation data without any neutrino masses. And it turns out that they get pretty far, which is very impressive. All that you need is to have many, many lepton number violating parameters, which, of course, you can, because, you know, anything that you write down will do that for you. So just to end, let me talk about a very specific test of CPT invariance, which has been very popular, which is, you know, can the neutrinos and antineutrinos have different mass? Now, theoretically, this is very messy, especially as far as understanding this at some, you know, writing down a theory that does that for you. That's really hard. On the other hand, it's really easy to just postulate this and go out and look for it. So this became very popular as a solution to the LS&D anomaly. Let me just say that now this is experimentally disfavored because Camlin saw a signal. And because the atmospheric data actually don't like the atmospheric antineutrinos to oscillate with such a big frequency. So, of course, the really exciting thing is that, well, that's not so exciting, but the one thing you can do is that, given that there's no evidence for CPT violation, you can use, you know, these new precision neutrino oscillation experiments to actually set bounds on a CPT violating observables. So I'm not going to spend any time on this, but just to say this is how you try to bind whether CPT violation can explain the LS&D anomaly and everybody else at the same time by imposing that the neutrinos and antineutrinos have different spectra. And the analysis is done in such a way that if you do an analysis of all the data except for LS&D, you can bind the delta m squared of the antineutrinos, and that's bound to be less than about a few times 10 to the minus 2 at the 3 sigma level. If you look at this line here, at the 3.6 sigma level, you might have some region of the parameter space where you can actually fit everybody with this model here. But this is disfavored at this kind of confidence level. Okay, of course, I will define two measures of CPT violation. One of them is a difference of delta m squareds. And another one is a difference of mixing angles. That's also CPT violation. CPT tells you that the masses are the same, and it also tells you that the mixings are the same. So just by looking at this plot, and actually Ed already showed a plot that looks like that, that looks like this one anyway, you can put bounds on how much can these two delta m squareds be different. And this bound is about, say, at the 10 to the minus 2 electron volt level. And this bound here on the mixing angle is pretty bad. You know, this delta sine squared theta is less than about a half. So you can have really big CPT violation in the mixing angle. Now, let's look at the solar data. Again, we're going to see this picture many, many times in the next year or so. But I think we should take some time to actually look at it and be very impressed by it. I mean, this is an absolute amazing achievement of our understanding of neutrino physics. Because we did one kind of an experiment, which is this contour here, which are solar neutrino experiments. Then we do a completely different experiment with reactor antineutrinos. And when we interpret both of them in terms of two-flavor neutrino oscillations, which is sort of a simplified version of the three-flavor neutrino oscillations, they agree. Okay, this is absolutely amazing, if you ask me. And they actually agree with some precision. And of course, the one thing we want to do is to go from this picture to that picture. And in order to do that, we have to assume the standard model. We can't do that if we don't assume the standard model in some form. And in particular, we also have to assume that CPT is conserved. If it isn't conserved, we can't do this step. Actually, we actually can't do it if there's any other kind of new physics around, which can modify, for example, the LMA solution. So let me skip this one because I don't have time. What happens is, because there's this agreement here, you can actually try to probe, you can put bounds on a CPT invariance. And of course, this delta m squared here can be bound, and it's pretty much bound by how high the LMA solution can go. So this bound is about, say, what, you know, at the 10 to the minus 4 electron volts level. And this can be improved if we actually can shrink the LMA solution in the delta m squared range, which is actually not very easy to do. Now, the other interesting thing which I want to point out in the last minute or so that I have is you can try to put a bound on this delta sine squared theta. And it turns out that you can never put a very good bound on delta sine squared theta. You actually get an absolutely awful bound, and it's not going to get any better. And the reason for that is that, you know, take the Camlin data, and let's assume that these error bars are going to shrink to zero, almost. What will happen always is that if you look at this picture, it's symmetric around tangent squared theta of 1 in the log scale. And it turns out that Camlin can't tell whether this point here is actually on the other side or not, especially if the delta m squared is this high, just because matter effects are very small at Camlin. So even at the end of the day, when Camlin goes out and says, we've measured delta m squared to 10%, we're not going to know whether the mixing angle is over here or over here. The only reason we know that, the only reason is we can draw this picture over here, which doesn't have a mirror on the other side, is because we're using the solar data. But if I assume that a CPT is violated, I can't do that. So the question is, can I actually improve on this bound? And in order to do that, you actually have to do a new experiment. And I've run out of time. Let me just go over this. What you want to do is you want to do an experiment with antineutrinos which have matter effects. That's hard. So some possibilities, I say supernova neutrinos or just very long baseline antineutrino oscillation experiments, which are sensitive to the Kamlin delta M squared. Needless to say, this is very hard. I'm going to skip this plot here. People can ask later. Let me just summarize this section here by saying, you know, are these bounds any good? I don't know how to answer that question. I can tell you that the bound on the kaon sector, if you write it in terms of these variables, is less than about 0.25 electron volts squared. And here we're talking about things at the 10 or minus 4 electron volts squared. So maybe the neutrino bounds are better. I'm not going to say this is true because this is sort of model dependent. Let me just conclude. So very quick conclusions. In this new standard model, all sorts of other neutrino properties are not expected, but you can still go out and look for them. So for example, because the neutrinos have mass and because we have a lot of data, we can actually put bounds and look for new physics just like everybody else can. So this is kind of exciting. So we can look for new physics just like people looking for mu to e gamma, people looking for electric dipole moments and whatnot. And again, let me emphasize, this is very exciting, is that neutrinos are a very narrow but very deep probe of very strange stuff. So, you know, they can look for, say, earth-shattering effects. And the consequences of this are such that they will completely revise our understanding of physics. So let me just say that maybe in 10 years, when somebody tries to make a picture of, you know, here's our understanding before the neutrinos have discovered that Lorentz invariance is violated, now we have a completely different model, which looks completely different, and we actually have no idea what it is. Maybe I can draw something that looks like that. So maybe I'll stand up here and say that here's the new standard model. Now we have this new effect, and this is how our picture of the world looks like today. This, of course, is a much more exciting picture. So let me end here. So thank you.
There. First, I want just to make some remark on your formula for magnetic moment. It's not so easy to get on the right-hand side just mass of the heavy fermion and then downstairs. Because of usually you have something like mass of neutrino in a cube, and you can substitute some of these powers.
Yes.
But it's next step of complication to remove mass of neutrino completely. So I want to ask you the following. Have you thought about Pauli principle conservation checks with neutrinos? Apparently, that can influence supernova dynamics, for instance, on physics or early universe?
The short answer is no, I haven't thought about this. It's certainly a logical test. I wouldn't know how to go about, I haven't thought about this, so I can't give you an intelligent answer. It's actually a very interesting question, yeah.
I'd like to make a small comment in the question. The comment is that it is almost inconceivable that magnetic transition moments come without electric ones. They are of the same order as you showed, and I also warn maybe they are not going to be bigger except for surprise than 10 to the minus 20 Bohr magnetons or so. The question is the CPT violation is not necessarily tied to neutrinos. So in this sense, my question is, why do you think that neutrinos are particularly sensitive?
Good, yeah, that's one thing I couldn't say, so I can go back and say it. Now, neutrino oscillation is a very impressive physical process. So neutrino oscillation in some sense, not in some sense, but if you think about it, it's an interference effect. Actually, it's a quantum interference effect that actually takes place at absolutely macroscopic distances. I think it's the world record on quantum coherence, because neutrinos actually remain coherent or they could have remained coherent, coherent if the delta M squared were very small when they come out of the sun. This is incredible. This doesn't happen, by the way. It doesn't happen because of the way that they're produced inside of the sun. But it could have happened if the delta M squared was, say, 10 to the minus 10. Now, this is really impressive. This is why we can see a neutrino mass at all. The neutrino mass is incredibly small. And any kinematical neutrino mass that you can try to look for, we know it doesn't work. I mean, we've tried really hard, and we're actually going to have a talk on this, but it's very hard to kinematically see the neutrino mass. The only reason we can see it is that oscillation is a quantum interference effect. So because of that, we're very sensitive to very, very tiny effects in a very specific way. That's why I actually write down that the neutrino is a very narrow but incredibly deep probe of new physics in a certain direction. So because of this quantum interference property, we can actually stand up here and say that if the seesaw mechanism is correct, neutrino physics is giving us information about physics at the gut scale, experimentally. We can't do that by doing an accelerator experiment. So that's why neutrino physics is a very exciting probe for these very exotic phenomena. Not all of them, of course, only a subset of them. But if you are sensitive to them, you're actually very sensitive to them. So that's why.
We have to move on. Let's thank the speaker again.